Br'er Rabbit and Johnny Five of the Flobots have always been students of social and political movements, and from their first release, Fight With Tools, their songs have had something to say and to celebrate about those movements. For the last several years, the Denver hip-hop group has been leading workshops across rural parts of Colorado and the U.S. to teach the art of song and its role in revolution. The Flobots studied the kind of music people have historically rallied behind, like Pete Seeger and the songs of the American Civil Rights Movement. I sat down with the two founding members and leaders of the band, Br'er Rabbit and Johnny Five, before their show last Saturday at the Paradise Cedar in Paonia. We discuss Standing Rock, Black Lives Matter, a Trump presidency, and how revolutions have to start at the dinner table. Here's that interview. Thanks for joining me today, you guys.
My pleasure.
Really excited to be here.
What are you guys working on these days? What's new in your world?
We've been pretty busy. We just finished an album that is going to be coming out in the very first part of 2017, and the album is called No Enemies. It's based on our experiences sort of trying to return the practice of singing back to the, you know, off the stage to the audience, to the community, and looking at what are the songs that affect the kind of emotional states of being that people who are engaged in social change go through, you know, whether that's just excitement, being on the front lines, you know, disappointment, failure, forgiveness, all of those emotions are reflected in the album, and we're really excited about it. It's some songs that are, I think, the best that we've written thus far, by far. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I think people will recognize the current moment very much so in this album. And then it also, we're including with that another album, which is recordings of this mass community choir that we assembled along with a second line orchestra that has songs that literally can be sung, you know, by groups of people while they're marching. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I already have chills. So this is coming out in the, when did you say?
First part of next year. We don't have a release date yet, but first part of 2017. And then at the same time, we're also working with a ballet group in Denver called Wonderbound on taking that entire piece, the entire album, and making it into a ballet that we'll perform live as part of the ballet. So that's in April. And, you know, folks can make it up to Denver for that. I think it will be well worth your while. We're in the process of just creating that right now, and it's going to be very exciting.
Cool. I watched something called Detour that you took part in, which was a project that brought you out to different parts of Colorado. And it seems like you're really invested in this state, and you stay here, and you're involved in a lot of community activity in Denver and around the state. Why do you throw so much energy and time into this state, and what do you love about it?
Well, I think in some ways, so much energy and time was thrown towards us. Jamie and I have grown up here. A lot of the members of the original band went to Denver Public High Schools and such. And we wouldn't have made it to a national stage and enjoyed the amount of limelight that we had if not for local support. So in a very real way, we feel like we owe every bit of our success to this wonderful state. And in the same way also, I feel like if you respect your roots, you continue to make great art. So being able to just really dig in to Colorado and get to see Colorado. And then the beautiful thing about what we did in Grand Junction or the Detour is we're not just there selling CDs. We're actually getting to meet people. We're getting to share with people. We're getting more from the folks of Grand Junction, more from the folks of Montrose than we would before just coming in and playing a show. And so we believe that the next phase for us as artists really involves us also making as many contributions as people are supporting us. We really want to make that more holistic, and we want to start with Colorado. And it's just been, world-changing for us as artists, making that kind of investment and slowing down a little bit and just being able to get to see the people of the state.
A lot of what you do is sort of mixing education in with the entertainment. And I know that Johnny Five has, you have a background in education, right? Didn't you start out as a para educator?
I started as a para, and then Stefan has a more extensive background.
Oh, do you? What's your background?
I have an alternate education license in elementary education.
What do you think makes a good teacher?
I feel like, you know, there's a lot of statements like there's two types of people in the world, but I think as far as education, you have people who have the hearts of a teacher, and you have people who have the heart of a student. And I actually think the best teachers are the people who have the heart of a student, because like it's much in the same way I feel like if we try to build a two-way street when we're doing our shows and performances with community, I feel like a lot of teachers who have the heart of the student would have a two-way street where they learn just as much from their students as they're giving to their students, if not more. And I feel like that kind of receptivity, that kind of curiosity, makes for the best kind of educator.
Mm. If we were all going to get schooled by the FlowBots right now, what do you think the lesson is that you're sending out there right now?
For the last few years, actually, we've had a pretty clear, agenda as to what we think our role is and what we want people to think about. And that's, what is the power of music off stage? Off stage meaning that it's not performance, but also off stage meaning that it's not, the domain of just a few individuals who have self-designated as musicians, as singers. We've been looking at what is the role that singing together, collective singing, shared singing, community singing, plays in social movements. What has it played in the past? What type of role has it played? How essential has it been? And then how central could it be today? Because I think in the last few years, we've seen a lot of people inspired by various issues and causes and movements. We've seen people marching in the streets. We've seen people doing direct action. We've seen people, taking a stand. And oftentimes with strangers or people they've just met through, a Facebook event, and they didn't know anyone when they showed up. And what we found is that it's wonderful to mobilize, but if you mobilize and you're with people and you have no semblance of any sort of common shared culture, it's harder to feel unified, and even it's harder to come away from that event with a feeling of that you want to return even. I mean, it can feel flimsy and feel a little bit awkward. And disunified. And so our role has been to actually gather people and say, let's practice this very simple but eternal resource of singing together, lifting our voices together, raising our voices together. And let's find whatever songs we can find that we might be able to sing together. The songs aren't as important. What matters is the practice of singing together and creating this sort of common culture from the fabric of the cultures that we all share, even if we think we don't have culture.
Hmm. It seems like we might be heading into a period of time where there's a lot more people gathering mm-hmm. for these kinds of protests or movements, with Standing Rock, with Black Lives Matter, mm-hmm. with the Trump presidency, mm-hmm. With a multitude of things that are going on that I think, people are going to get more active. What would you say they should include in their activism specifically?
Well, I mean, I think the missing piece is actually having places where we gather before there's a march or an action. I mean, there's so few places that people can point to say that's my community. So if it's not your faith community, maybe it's your book club, or maybe it's your group of friends, or maybe it's just a community event that happens. But we need to know each other as people, so that if we are stepping out into the streets and we're suddenly sort of these like co-participants in something that might be risky or might be just a chance to kind of raise our voices, we need to know the person that we're standing next to beyond just that we have the same placard.
Mm-hmm. Did you observe what was happening at Standing Rock at all?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I felt like they had a pretty strong message of peace. I felt like they were organized around that.
I think what was exciting about Standing Rock was that it was a line drawn in the sand that resonated with people on so many levels. And it brought together a lot of concerns and kind of facets of different movements that people often see as separate, and they were very unified. This is about respecting the sovereignty of First Nations people. This is about saying water is a shared resource that matters to every single one of us. Water is life, and that any of us would be a fool to let that to put that resource at risk. And so it's about our children's future. It's about, you could call that an environmental movement, but it kind of belittles it to just reduce it to any one thing. There's a shared resource. There's a basic level of respect for this shared resource, and if it's kind of a non-negotiable. And so mm-hmm. I think people, the meshes I heard around that, I mean, the fact that people call themselves water protectors and not protesters, this wasn't like, we need our voices heard. It was like, no, we need this resource protected And we're going to be, you know, drawing this line and rallying folks together to make sure the resource is protected.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. But it's also very interesting to see how different narratives around certain movements get carried out. Because I think I would venture to say that most of the movements that we see right now, short of what the Bundys did, have been ostensibly nonviolent. But the phrasing around them has, there's been a lot of effort to portray them as being violent when, and I think there's a big difference between a group of organizers who have this type of agenda and then a group of people who are also just feeling entirely disenfranchised. And like, if a riot breaks out or those type of things, it actually doesn't make the movement in itself violent. But when people have no way to be heard, that's an entirely different thing. But it's really interesting, even historically, because I talk with lots of folks. We talk with lots of folks on the different perceived sides of issues. And I say perceived because it's perception. And a lot of the things that people would say about Black Lives Matter when it came to blocking a bridge. And then they would say, well, Martin Luther King never blocked a bridge. Well, yes, he did. He did very famously. And if you go and look back at the way that Dr. King was talked about, it's the same kind of fear. People are worried about violence. They're saying that like he's dividing more than he's bringing folks together. And it's really, really fascinating when you start becoming a student of movements that you realize that every time you go forth and do something, it does polarize to some degree. But I think that's what was really special, as Jamie was saying about Standing Rock, is that the layers of it made it very difficult to be on the opposite side of this one. Like in particular, like everybody, it does not matter like what side of the political spectrum you are. We know that the Native Americans have been like ritually disenfranchised by the United States government. And like, and the pipeline was an incredible violation of treaties and all of these things. So there wasn't much to stand on in the opposition. But I do think that if we are able to look compassionately at a lot of causes, we probably would find them to be in the same kind of way justifiable. But our compassion does have a certain limited capacity when we're talking about 140 characters or Facebook algorithms that cater only to how we agree.
Stand up. We shall not be moved except by a child with no socks and shoes. If you got more to give, then you've got to prove. Put your hands up and I'll copy you. Stand up. We shall not be moved except by a woman dying from a loss of food. If you've got more to give, then you've got to prove. Put your hands up and I'll copy you. We still don't understand. Thunder with lightning flash back to when we didn't fund the dam. Didn't fund the dam levy? No wonder, man. Now a whole damn city's torn asunder, man. Underwater, but we still don't understand. We see hurricane spills overrun the land through gaps you couldn't fill with 100 tons of sand. No, we still don't understand. We've seen planes in the windows of buildings crumbled in. We've seen flames sending chills through London, and we've sent planes to kill them, and some of them are children, but still we crumble in the building. Underfunded, but we still don't understand. Under God, but we kill like the son of Sam. But if you feel like I feel about the son of man, we will overcome. So stand up. We shall not be moved except by a child with no socks and shoes. If you've got more to give, then you've got to prove. Put your hands up and I'll copy you. And stand up. We shall not be moved except by a woman dying from a loss of food. If you've got more to give, then you've got to prove. Put your hands up and I'll copy you. I said put your hands up and I'll copy you. Put your hands up and I'll copy you. If you've got more to give, then you've got to prove. Put your hands up and I'll copy you. We shall not be moved except by a child with no socks and shoes, except by a woman dying from a loss of food, except by a freedom fighter bleeding on a cross for you. We shall not be moved except by a system that's rotten through, neglecting the victims and ordering the cops to shoot. High treason, now we need to prosecute. So stand up. We shall not be moved, and we won't fight a war for a fossil fuel. Of time like this, make you wanna plot a coup. Put your hands up and I'll copy you. Stand up. Stand up. We shall not be moved unless we're taking a route we have not pursued. So if you've got a dream and a lot to do, put your hands up and I'll copy you. I said put your hands up and I'll copy you.
put your hands up and I'll copy you. If you've got a dream and a lot to do, put your hands up. Now shake, shake a Polaroid dream. Nightmare negatives develop on the screen. We sit back and wait for the government team. Criticize they, but who the fuck are we? The people want peace, but the leaders want war. Neighbors don't speak, peek through the front door. House representatives, please stay the course.
It's time for a leap of faith.
Once more, put your hands up high if you haven't abandoned. Hope that the pen stroke's stronger than the cannon. Balls to the wall, nose to the grindstone.
My interrogation techniques leave your mind blown.
Place your bets, let's speak to the enemy. Don't let him pretend that we seek blood. And who's we anyway? Kimosabe, mighty warlord, wannabe street thug. A threat for a threat leaves the whole world terrified. Blow for blow never settles the score. Word for word, it's time we clarify. We the people did not want war. So stand up.
Stand up,
we shall not be moved. Except by a child with no socks and shoes. If you've got more to give, then you've got to prove. Put your hands up and I'll copy you. Stand up,
stand up.
We shall not be moved. Unless we're taking a route we have not pursued. So if you've got a dream and a lot to do, put your hands up and I'll copy you. I said put your hands up and I'll copy you. Put your hands up and I'll copy you. If you've got a dream and a lot to do, put your hands up.
Stand Up from the Flowbots. Band members Br'er Rabbit and Johnny Five sat down with me last Saturday. Our discussion continues. I was just listening to the song Run, Run, Run and the lyrics where you talk about how revolution is sort of can be commodified. Do you think anything can be commodified? Because I find that, you know, certainly revolution can be commodified. Love can be commodified. How do you stop it from turning into something like that as an artist?
Well, it has to go with where you start, honestly. That was the big issue for us when we signed to a major label, is that we knew very clearly where we wanted to start with our message. But a major label wouldn't be interested unless they believe that there's an opportunity to commodify it. So I think in some ways, you're kind of, it's not necessarily a dance with the devil if you know what you're trying to get out of it. So when we signed our deal with the record label, we knew that the reason that we were doing it is that we wanted a larger platform to get this message out to people. That was the main purpose. And to that effect, it worked out. But then as far as the commodification thing and as strategies as artists, I feel like you have to be able to pivot and continue to be prolific. Because commodification is still an industry. An industry is built by precedents and market trends. So it's not necessarily that dynamic. So if the market trend goes this way, then that means you have a plurality of options in the other direction. And as an artist, you have all these other ways to go. Commodification is just trying to get to people's desire for want or incompleteness. So there's so many other emotions that we get to speak to. And that's one of the reasons why we started the project No Enemies. We're like, okay, well, if stuff's commodified this way, then where's all these other places that music can reach folks? Mm-hmm. Where are all the ways that human beings are built for music to reach us, especially when you deprofessionalize it? What are those opportunities? And after taking about 2 years of exploring those opportunities, that's actually where our new album came out of. Mm-hmm. So it gave us a great foundation, because exactly is what you're saying. We had to pivot. We're like, this is the commodification way. All right, we're not trying to write hits or anything like that. Let's start with doing music for the streets. This is the stuff like Pete Seeger did and all these things. Let's follow in these footsteps, learn these songs, find this out, and then write music in that way. And that's where the new album came out of. So I find it as like kind of a nice, I consider it almost a creative partner who I don't listen to, which is commodification. It's like, okay, whatever commodification is saying, all right, whatever. Right. And let's go and do something else. And it feels, then it can be like a good barometer for it being more vital.
And it was interesting. There really were just layers of mental barriers that now some of them seem kind of silly, but they were quite real. And I remember even a few years before we were even starting it, the project of No Enemies, where we gather people to sing, we started talking about, well, what if we were to write songs for that? And it felt like it was, you know, narrow. It's like, well, if we just write songs that are used for protests, you know, that's not really relevant to most people. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't make sense on that level. And also, you know, we're if we're maybe more rappers than singers and this, we're putting our best foot forward, we would be, you know, aesthetically maybe we wouldn't go there. And there was a number of levels where we had to get over some humps and say, look, this is actually vital and important. And I think one of the bigger ones is that we're used to being that person on the stage. You know, we don't want to put ourselves out of a job if we tell the people in the audience, like, no, you don't need us. You can sing on your own. It's like, well, what are we here for? So there's all these levels where you're kind of in, the industry sort of incentivizes the other direction of like making people feel like they can't sing, making people feel like they can't raise their voice unless we're there, unless they pay money to come into a concert and we bring the music because we're the musicians, where actually people have the music with them. So it was only because I think we felt called and we saw that our product with this kind of political rap veneer that we were, it was working and people were saying, yeah, we want to buy into that. So we're going to go out in the streets. And then once they were there, we weren't actually equipping them with songs that could be sung in the streets. You're not going to all sing Handlebars during a march, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so even these songs that had gotten people to want to be there didn't equip people once they were there. And we said, okay, there's actually some real responsibility to then on a practical level, equip people with tools that keep them safe, energized, excited, unified in those situations.
They said no one could ever, ever do what had been done. And they inspired us from Babylon to Avalon. We saw that they were headed somewhere fast and tried to tag along like a vagabond. So we battled on all over the map. It's not a sprint, it's a decathlon. Everybody run, run.
That was the song Run from the Flowbots. You're listening to an interview with members of the band Johnny Five and Br'er Rabbit. So you've said one of the main inspirations for the Flobots is Dr. Vincent Harding.
Absolutely.
And he was a leader in the Southern Freedom Movement and a friend and speechwriter for Martin Luther King Jr. And I feel like obviously this is some part of what his message was, that the singing and music was important in a movement. Is that where that came from for you guys? And how else did he kind of move you to do what you do?
It's absolutely, absolutely. Jamie and I, we've been friends since the fourth grade. And Dr. Harding was a family friend who was so close that he was known as Uncle Vincent. Mm. And so he was a constant figure in our lives as we were young children and two young men, and really helped shape our development as activists because of his extensive background and such. So even when we were first taking our stumbling steps and using music to kind of organize and doing our own things, we're bringing activists together, he would come. And something that's really unique among elders, but not unique among true educators, is that he had the heart of a student. So instead of presiding over our events and telling us all the things that we were doing wrong, he was just there for support. And then when we asked him, what are some things that we could change? His feedback was always the same. He always asked, where are the songs? Mm. And at first, it was a question that we didn't know how to process. We're like, well, no, we're musicians, we're doing them, we're making albums, we're doing all right. Like, those are the songs. And it really became far more clear upon his passing. When we started, when that question still echoed in our consciousnesses, we're like, oh, we started looking at the role that the songs have played in the Southern Freedom Movement. Because it's easy to look back on it and kind of mythologize it as just like some other cultural happening in place and time. But when you started looking at songs as technology, these vistas opened up. And we got liberated and we realized there's a difference between songs of performance, and those are the ones that you put on a CD. Those are the ones that people come and pay for at a show. And songs of power. And those are the songs that people sing in the streets. And they're actually different in the way that they're built. The songs of power, usually you can hear it once and then you're able to sing along with it. Or you can hear it go through one rotation and be able to sing along with it. And it's usually very emotionally evocative, but also very... it's very intuitive how it reaches the issue on an emotional level. And using his question to kind of spur us into this new phase of being able to bring our activism and our art together seamlessly, that's all been the effort of us trying to answer Uncle Vincent's question, where are the songs? And it's been beautiful to be exploring that. And we are so thankful for his presence in our lives.
Today you don't have to be a soldier, don't have to be a soldier standing. It's okay to be as you were, be as you were again.
Is it a scheme? Is it a vision? Is it a dream? Is it a nightmare? Or is it a competition? And if it is, what if we don't fight fair? What's bald in the morning but in the evening has white hairs? What's the cause of global warming? And could it be these things right here? I got an idea that might not reach anyone for another light year. Got a hit list and a cloud of witnesses. Which is pricier? Well, my tears are mightier than my fears. So mighty earth provides me hurt that I keep buried until I convert it to writing. I was wounded, I was injured, I was made to move to Denver. I was taken through a new adventure, paint stripped from its first picture. I was placed in another picture. I was rushed to a new landscape and ripped away from family, scraped into a politician's mistake.
And what's left of town is in chest, beneath oceans welled up behind Ivy's head. Yet to be salvaged, the world of emotions, a guess that it might be okay, that it could be alright.
Be a soldier standing. It's okay
man-machine, damaging everything I touch by not caring enough or too much. Am I a far-flung fantasy, setting free enmity and making friends from enemies? Bridges for the in-betweens, for the highwayman on the low road, the tie your back with a large load, the trial span till I found hope, and I found more when I slow-mo. Enough of the back to face front, let those in the pack of the race run. I'm needing an even a pace, one too hasty makes mistakes. Arms can bear that you keep from harm. It will be there when you go wrong. Make a heart with your bond, your treasures right.
And what's left of talents in chest beneath oceans welled up behind islands has yet to be salvaged. The world of emotions, a guess that it might be okay, that it could be alright.
And I'm here with Johnny Five and Br'er Rabbit of Flowbots, and they're performing tonight at the Paradise Theater in Paonia. Thank you guys so much for being here.
Absolutely.
Thank you for having us.
In researching you guys, I watched a short film called I Know a Lot About Hip Hop. And I think you made but way back when, right? It was probably like when you first started after you kind of hit with Handlebars and everything. And there were a bunch of comedic scenes, and you basically played yourselves in this. So there's this one character that is talking black to Br'er Rabbit talking white to Johnny Five.
Right.
And you tell him you don't need to talk, you know, differently to us. And he goes, well, should I talk to you like you're black or white?
Right.
And I just thought it was a really...
Were you wondering today?
Funny.
Personally.
I was wondering if I should talk to you black or white.
Okay.
I just thought it was a clever way to, you know, look at stereotype and kind of cultural misappropriation. Mm-hmm. And you must be exposed to that a lot, actually, because it's a very sort of multicultural band and what you're singing about. And because hip hop, you know, there's some race issues that come up around that. Do you think that we're going to be okay to talk about race, or we're going to know how to talk about it a little bit better in this country anytime soon? Because I feel like it's all getting so crazy right now on so many levels with the issue of race in the United States. And it's not that it's new things. It's actually old things that are being exposed. I guess my question is, do you see us going in a positive direction? Where's the silver lining here with race in America? Kind of a huge question.
I mean, I think one thing that's extremely important about just any type of conversation right now is that a conversation with a real person in real life who you already know and have some trust with is going to be the most effective conversation. A conversation with someone you don't know at all on Facebook, you know, typed back and forth in the heat of that feeling you get when you're like, this person's wrong. I'm going to show them that they're wrong. Oh no, they're not going to show me that I'm wrong. Oh wait, maybe they just did. You know, that kind of like descending into trying to save face publicly in this vitriolic back and forth. That's the absolute worst place in time to have a conversation. But I think that mode of conversation has become fairly dominant in a lot of people's experience. And there's also a whole host of entities out there with a financial interest in keeping us engaged digitally rather than in real life. So I think one thing that really is important is just do we have those relationships? Do we have those friendships? Do we have those family relationships where we can start to talk about anything in a way that is three-dimensional? So I would start there. And I think that actually the digital realm, which is so prone to kind of like, you know, crafting the right language and then critiquing, the art of critique, the art of outrage, and figuring out like, how can you pick at this person, rather than looking at the person holistically and saying, how do we have this more full conversation? I think that's something that we need to actually be really vigilant about in our own dealings with other people, because there's a lot of important stuff that you know, it's good to have a heated conversation. It can be very productive to have a heated conversation, but have that in person,
especially when it comes to like any of these issues that have been brought to the fore, particularly this election brought many up. I think ultimately it's all productive, because all of these things actually needed to be talked about. And as far as race, some people perceive that the conversation has worsened, but I very much would push against that, because I think that we spent a few years not talking about it. And I think that's why it feels worse. If you have some sort of family issue, something has happened among your family members and nobody's talking about it because they're so injured about it, right? And then it seeps and festers for a few years. When it finally does come up, it's not going to be pleasant. I think that in order for something to be worse, I think somebody would have to point to a point in time where it was better. And I don't think that that's where we are. I think that conversations around race, conversations around gender, around class, around many different issues have still been largely not participated in by the public at large. So any point in time that these things start coming up, it's going to feel bad at first. And then also when you're talking about things like race or any of these, you're talking about increasing complexity as we understand more and more about it, from physiological to economic to historic. And so I think it feels bad, but I think also with it feeling bad, we have a real opportunity to not shut up. And then do as Jamie is talking about and try to take as many of those conversations offline and finding human beings. Because despite what we believe, even though we're able to theoretically reach almost any human being in the world through our computers, we're not actually reaching them. We're reaching them in a certain state. Like if I had a telephone that I knew that anytime I called somebody, they'd be their most irritated and agitated state, I wouldn't be using it very often. But that's what Facebook ends up being a lot of the times. That's what social media can sometimes be. But if we allow ourselves to be perpetual students, if we allow ourselves to be actually curious about a story that's not our own, if we can actually believe that everybody's experience is not like ours and there might be stories that are different, then I think some of that curiosity might help carry over into those conversations of genuine communication. But if we continue to do what is easy and what seems most natural and what seems most common sense, then we'll actually exclude most other people's realities.
I want to add, too, that I think there is a, you know, folks who are, you know, European-American or identify as white, there's this fragility or this defensiveness that people will very frequently jump to as soon as anything is said that in any way appears to be critical or could be interpreted as critical of kind of normative culture or white people or mm-hmm. and you could see that fragility in a lot of conversations that it leaps straight to some really non sequitur places. For example, when you have Black Lives Matter, a movement talking about many things but especially addressing police violence, well, I think no matter where you are in that conversation, you could name a few instances where you think that was utterly abhorrent that this person lost their life in an interaction with police in which, you know, they did X, Y, Z and still were ended up being killed. Or, you know, the man in Florida who was shot even as his hands were in the air and he was lying on the ground and he was trying to deal with a young man who was his client. He was a behavioral health therapist. So no matter what, there's these situations where you can look at it and say, oh, that isn't what we want as the behavior of our police force. And that's something that benefits, if the solution is reached, benefits everybody. It's being brought up by Black Lives Matter. And so you can look at that situation and get really defensive around, well, what about my life? Does my life not matter? Is that what you're saying? Or you could say, wait a second, what's the question being asked? And the question being asked is, how do we actually stop these sort of egregious killings that almost everyone agrees we don't want to see? And so I think the more productive response would be to say, well, okay, what could I do to help bring about some solutions to this issue that has been raised? Can I go to my local police department and read the training manual on use of force and see what I agree with or don't agree with? There's so much productive work that could be done in response to issues being raised. And I think in some ways, when people receive it only as this is a conversation about race and nothing more, then it becomes stuck on that, and we get to this kind of narcissistic place of like, are they saying I'm a racist?
Yeah.
Oh, someone called me, I'm not a racist. Oh, am I? So what do I have to do to not be racist? And it becomes all about me. But there's a reason it's framed as Black Lives Matter. It's because this conversation wasn't happening a few years ago, and people, if African Americans being killed by police, it wasn't making the news. It wasn't in the news. And so now it is. But the potential for it to benefit far and wide beyond folks in the Black community it's almost inevitable. There's no way for that to only benefit the Black community if we actually pursue solutions.
Right.
It will benefit the entire community. So I think it's kind of on white folks to say, like, all right, if I'm hearing this issue raised, how do I respond productively?
Right.
And in something that will benefit my family and my community. Of all, people in my community of all races.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I felt like with the Trump campaign, when different things would come up too around the way he talked about women or the quote locker room talk and things like that. And I was talking to a male family member and I was telling him that it upset me, that I felt like women were treated this way more often than people even realize, and that it was bringing a lot of things up for a lot of women. And
Absolutely.
He took it like he got really defensive, like as if I was directing all of my frustration about that to him personally. And I was like, I don't need you to, I just want you to say, yes, I believe that's happening. Or, I'm sorry that you feel that, it was weird how suddenly he got very like it was all his fault.
Sometimes I do wonder if that has to do with our culture really is punitive in nature. I mean, we shame people for saying the wrong things. Mm-hmm. We still have the death penalty. There's this sense of like, there's forgiveness is a real countercultural concept. And so I don't know if you hear something and you think, well, maybe I did say something kind of like that once, and oh, I think I haven't done exactly what that person did, but I have done sort of similar things, and now are they going to come after me? I think people can quickly go to that inward spiral of defensiveness rather than like, it might be good information if you could then have an open conversation and say, oh, right, I was often speaking this way. And I think Trump becomes this villain of, rating women from the scale of 1 to 10. Well, we were in a space recently where somebody did that same thing, and we kind of it was like, no, we don't do that. But it took a second. Trump has actually brought that out by being this kind of absolute villain on issues like that to say, yeah, actually, we don't. That's a really bad thing that is happening, and so let's actually have some consensus around that and move some steps forward.
Right.
He's become a real what not to do figure in many ways. And just like also speaking to it's a very interesting kind of basic human reaction around, well, I remember like how it plays out in the back seat of a car with like my sister on a road trip when we were kids. Like we're all doing like, well, I'm not touching you, or I'm not crossing the line, or like I might flicker, right, and give like a quick like flick on her earlobe, and she'd be like, ow, that hurts. And my first reaction is not, oh, I'm sorry, it's no, it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
No, it doesn't. And I feel as though right now as a society, we kind of have that response to other people's pain. We're just like, no, it doesn't. No, it doesn't hurt. We do whatever we can to kind of somehow invalidate it and then defend ourselves, which is really fascinating. Because I feel as though if we could just kind of look at it like, wait, pain is information. And in many ways, it's not for us to decide if somebody else is hurting. So why would we choose to totally invalidate that? And I really say we. I really mean we. Because it feels like the way our conversations go right now is we're spending a lot of time invalidating each other's pain and invalidating each other's stories. And I think in some ways you could even find among like the conservative right that they were able to invalidate the pain of poor white conservatives to such a degree that even poor white conservatives invalidated their pain as well. But it's just we keep on looking at like for basic small moves that we can do. And like one of the reasons that was like, wait, we shouldn't let somebody be like a woman be raided in our presence. As a way to like just be a little bit more responsive to the fact that, and it's not saying that all these people are complaining or weak or any of those things. But I think is that we're trying to step into our capacity of strength because the ultimate expression of strength is kindness. Mm-hmm. So we should be able to be kind enough to respond to somebody's pain other than saying, nah. And I feel like that's a small move that a lot of people could be making right now. Because the other situation is then you've got somebody who is in pain and then they're under trial trying to prove it. Mm. So, I mean, there have been so many different times where I have to talk to members of my family who are white about the legitimate concerns of Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. And then, like, just trying to say, well, this is the issue. It's saying, like, I'm saying, like, the reason it's called Black Lives Matter is that if you look at the history of the United States of America, they did not. Like, this is an aspirational phrase. We're trying to ensure that it does matter. And I have to explain to them, like, look at me. I am your son-in-law. And my family did Herculean efforts to keep me out of prison. Not because I was on that track, but because of my skin color, I was born on that track. And I had to do so many things to make sure that I didn't go to prison. There's so many times where I'd been accosted by police. There was one Sunday morning I was petting a cat cross-legged. In the middle of the day, I got accosted by two police officers who said I matched the description of somebody who had done a bunch of burglaries. If not for my friend living one house down and her family and their family coming out and vouching for me, they would have put me in the back of a car. It's like that kind of reality, that kind of pain, when they get to actually hear it and see it at the dinner table, I feel like it gets to be transformative. Mm-hmm. So once again, we're just talking full circle about like, how can we get these dinner table conversations, these dinner table revolutions? How do we arm our curiosity and ensure that our curiosity extends to other people's pain? So they don't have to be on trial when they're also feeling pain. We don't have to redouble it when they have to prove it.
We don't know how to be but angry. Feel infected like we got gangrene. Please don't let anybody try to change me. Me, just me in the middle of a sea full of faces, full of faces. Some laugh, some salivate. What's in your alleyway? Recycling bins or bullet cases? It's not equal, it's not fair. We're different people, but we're not scared. We ain't never scared to pave a new path, make a new street, build a new bridge. Say, can you see by the dawn's early light? Free slaves running, songs, words weren't right. Now a new day's coming, the few stay stunning. While the many are handsome, your soul is alive, but they want it for ransom. The bass drumming is the anthem. We step to the heartbeats of our granddaughters and grandsons and rise together. We 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 rise.
Lost hope and found need. Grounded by your surroundings. Did the walls scream universities? Or you and I verse the tease? React automatic and we burst and squeeze. And make 9-11 each emergency. Urgency, amber to red like the turning leaves. Oh, please let the hurting cease.
Don't let apathy police the populace. We will march across those stereotypes that were marked for us. The answer's obvious. We switch the consonants and change the sword to words and lift continents.
Rise together, we rise together.
You've been listening to an interview with Br'er Rabbit and Johnny Five of the Denver hip-hop band Flobots. That was their song, Rise Up. I'm Allie Lightfoot. Thanks for tuning in to Talkin' Music.
I can ride my bike with no handlebars. No handlebars, no handlebars. I can ride my bike with no handlebars. No handlebars, no handlebars.
Look at me, look at me. Hands in the air like it's good to be alive. And I'm a famous rapper even when the paths are all crooked-y. I can show you how to do-si-do. I can show you how to scratch a record. I can take apart the remote control. And I can almost put it back together. I can tie a knot in a cherry stem. I can tell you about Leif Erikson. I know all the words to De Colores. And I'm proud to be an American. Me and my friend saw a platypus. Me and my friend made a comic book. And guess how long it took. I can do anything that I want. Cause look, I can keep rhythm with no metronome. No metronome, no metronome. And I can see your face on the telephone. On the telephone, on the telephone. Look at me, look at me. Just called to say that it's good to be alive. In such a small world, I'm all curled up with a book to read. I can make money, open up a thrift store. I can make a living off a magazine. I can design an engine 64 miles to a gallon of gasoline. I can make new antibiotics. I can make computers survive aquatic conditions. I know how to run the business. And I can make you want to buy a product. Movers, shakers, and producers. Me and my friends understand the future. I see the strings that control the system. I can do anything with no resistance. Cause I can lead a nation with a microphone. With a microphone, with a microphone. And I can split the atom of a molecule. Of a molecule, of a molecule. We'll be right back.
My reach is global, my tower secure. My cause is noble, my power is pure. I can hand out a million vaccinations, or let them all die in exasperation. Have them all heal from the lacerations, have them all killed by assassination. I can make anybody go to prison just because I don't like them. And I can do anything with no permission. I have it all under my command because I can guide a missile by satellite, by satellite, by satellite. And I can hit a target through a telescope, through a telescope, through a telescope. And I can end the planet in a holocaust, 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 in a holocaust.
With no handlebars, no handlebars, no handlebars. I can ride my bike.